The Fuller Memorandum, Disc 3.
Chapter 5. Lost in Committee. I go back to Harry's place and collect my kit. Then I catch the bus home, shoulders itching every time it passes a police car. Yes, I'm legally allowed to carry the Glock and its accessories, which are sleeping in my day sack in a combination locked case. The gun and its charmed holster are supposed to be invisible to anyone who doesn't carry a laundry warrant card, but I'll believe it when I see it. Luckily, the bus is not stormed by an armed SO-19 unit performing a random check for implausible weapons. I arrive home uneventfully, unpack the gun and place it on the bedroom mantelpiece, which is just to the left of my side of the bed, and go downstairs to sort out supper with Mo. Friday happens, and then the weekend. I register the Jesus phone. It wants a name, and Mo suggests christening it, if that's the right word, the Necronomipod. Her attitude has turned to one of proprietorial interest, if not outright lust. Damn it, I am going to have to buy her one. We do not discuss work at all. We are not doorstepped by zombies, shot at, blown up, or otherwise disturbed, although our next-door neighbor's teenage son spends a goodly chunk of Saturday evening playing I Kissed a Girl so loudly that Mo and I nearly come to blows over the pressing question of how best to respond. I'm arguing for Einstürzende Neubauten, delivered over the speakers of doom. She's a proponent of Schoenberg, delivered via the violin that kills monsters. In the end, we agree on the polite voice of reason, delivered via the ears of his parents. I guess we must be growing old. On Saturday morning, it turns out that we are running low on groceries. "Why not go online and book a delivery from Tesco?" asks Mo. I spend a futile hour struggling with their web server before admitting to myself that my abstruse combination of Firefox plugins, security filters, and firewalls, not to mention running on an operating system that the big box retailers' programmers wouldn't recognize if it stuck a fork in them, makes this somewhat impractical, by which time we've missed the last delivery, so it looks as if we're going to have to go forth and brave the world on foot. So I cautiously hook the Invisi Glock to my belt for the first time, pull my baggiest jacket down to cover it, and Mo and I hit the road. Anticlimax. As we trudge home from the supermarket, laden down with carrier bags, I begin to relax slightly. Even when my jacket got caught up on the front of a suicide granny's shopping trolley, nobody noticed the hardware and started screaming. This is 21st century England, home of handgun hysteria. They're not being polite. "By the way," Mo comments edgily as we wait to cross a main road, "don't you think you should be keeping your right hand free?" I scan the surroundings for feral, supernatural wildlife. If I need my hand, the shopping can take its chances.
"Then don't you think it'd be better to be carrying the bag with the bread and cheese in that hand, rather than the milk and the jar of pickled cucumbers?"
I swear quietly, try to switch hands, and get the bags inextricably entangled, just as the green man illuminates. We are a cover-free couple for the entire duration of our panicky scurry across the street crossing. "I should have held out for an attack alarm," I grumble.
"We'll sort one out on Monday," Mo says absent-mindedly. "Watch the vegetables, dear."
On Sunday, we're due to have lunch with my parents, which means catching the tube halfway across London and then rattling way the hell out into suburbia on a commuter line run by a bus company distinguished for their hatred and contempt for rail travellers. I wear the holster, this time keeping my right hand free, and Mo carts her violin case along. Our trains are not ambushed by dragons, suicide bombers, or Thonian tentacle monsters. Frankly, given the quality of the postprandial conversation, this is not a net positive. Mo's face acquires much the same impassive expressiveness as an irritated Komodo dragon when Mum makes the usual fatuous and thoughtless comment about wishing for the patter of tiny feet. We are not, perforce, allowed to discuss our work in the presence of civilians, so we are short of conversational munitions with which to retaliate. They still think I work in computer support, and Mo's some sort of statistician. By the time we make our excuses and leave, I'm thinking that maybe I'd better leave the gun behind on future parental visits. "Did you enjoy the vegetables?" I ask the steaming vortex of silence beside me as we walk back up the street towards the railway station.
"I thought you were going to roast them at one point."
"Sorry, I'm chicken," she sighs.
"You don't need to apologize for your parents, Bob. They'll get over it eventually."
"They're not to know." I glance back over my shoulder.
We could, you know. There's still time, if you want.
Time to fit in all the heartbreak and pain of raising wee ones so they're just old enough to appreciate the horror of it all? No thanks.
We've had this conversation before, a few times. Revisited the situation for an update. No, the world we work in isn't a suitable one to inflict on a child you love.
Besides, you're not the one who'd have to go through a first pregnancy in your late 30s.
Certainly not just to please them.
We walk back to the station in morose silence. A 30-something couple out for a Sunday afternoon stroll. Nobody watching us needs to know that we're pissed off, armed, and on the lookout for trouble. It's probably a very good thing indeed for the local muggers that they're still sleeping off their Saturday night hangovers.
Monday dawns bright and hot and early, and I find myself waking to the happy knowledge that I can go back to work, and nobody will order me home. I roll over, feel the cooling depression across the mattress, continue my roll and sit up, relieved, on the wrong side of the bed. Mo's clearly been up for a while. When I catch up with her in the kitchen, she's listlessly spooning up a bowl of yogurt and gerbil food. I attend to the cafetiere. She's wearing what I think of as her job interview suit.
What's up? I ask. Need to look the part for an offsite. She frowns. Do you think this looks businesslike?
Very. She looks like she's about to foreclose on my mortgage. I spill coffee grounds all over the worktop, finish spooning the brown stuff into the jug, and add boiling water.
What kind of meeting?
Got to see a man about a violin. Conservation.
Conservation? They don't grow in trees, you know.
The frown relaxes.
It's not something common like a Stradivarius. We've got 3 on inventory, but only 12 were ever made, and they're all unavailable for one reason or another. A couple got bombed during the war, 3 are unaccounted for, presumed lost during extra-dimensional excursions, and the rest belong to other agencies or collectors we can't touch. Operational assets are looking for a supplier who can make more of them, but it's turning out to be really difficult. Nobody's quite sure of the order in which Zahn applied his bindings. And as for what it's made of, just owning the necessary supplies probably puts you in breach of the Human Tissues Act of 2004, not to mention a raft of other legislation.
Ow. I look at the battered violin case, propped up in the corner next to the recyclables bin. That's the trouble with a defense policy based on occult weapons. The sort of folks who make magic swords can rarely be bothered with the BS 5750 quality certification required by government procurement committees.
So what are you doing?
Carting my violin across town so an expert can examine it. She finishes her cereal bowl.
A restorer, very expensive, very exclusive. The cover story is, I'm working for one of the big auction houses, and we've been commissioned to get an estimate of its worth.
Don't look at me like that. They do this all the time, for stuff they don't have any in-house expertise with. I've got to go along because our other 2 violins are booked solid, and I'm not letting this one out of my sight.
She eyes the coffee pot.
What are you planning?
Got to go see Iris after her morning meeting. Then we'll see.
My cheek twitches as I pour 2 mugs of coffee.
Got some files to read. Angleton told me to deputise for him on a committee. Then there's the structured cabling in D-Block to worry about. The glamorous life of the secret agent, when he's not actually out there saving the world.
I was thinking, that story Andy came up with. Do you want to look into it? Sanity check Dr. Ford's analysis?
I finish the question slowly, trying not to think too hard about the implications.
You read my mind.
She adds milk to her coffee, stirring.
Not that everybody else in research and development with Case Nightmare Green won't be doing exactly the same thing, but you never know. I think I'll go pay Mike a little visit this afternoon, if he's got time.
She looks at me, eyes wide. They're blue-green, I notice. It's funny, that. I don't usually pay attention to her eyes.
Are you all right?
I nod. I'm just a little unfocused today.
You and me both.
She manages a little laugh by way of conversational punctuation.
Well, I need to be off.
She takes a 2 big mouthful of coffee and winces.
Sorry I'm leaving you with the washing up again.
That's okay. I've got an extra hour. No point showing up before Iris's steering group meeting, is there?
Take care. I will.
She picks up her handbag and the violin case and heads for the door, heels clicking.
Bye.
And she's away, looking more like an accountant than a combat epistemologist. I putter around for a while, then get dressed. Jeans, t-shirt, gun belt, and linen blazer. Mine is not a customer-facing job at present, and I hate ties, and prepare to head out. At the last minute, I remember the Necronomipod, sleeping, but not dead, beside the laptop. I grab it, along with my usual phone, and head for the bus stop. "Welcome to Bloody Baron," says Iris, offering me a recycled cardboard folder with "Most Secret" stamped on the cover. "You have 2 hours to familiarize yourself with the contents before the Monday afternoon team meeting." She smiles brightly as she drops it on my desk, right on top of the archive box full of dusty paperwork that I've just signed for, care of the wee man with the handcart who does the twice-daily run to the stacks. "There will be an exam. On the upside, I've given your structured cabling files to Peter Fred, and the departmental email security awareness committee meeting for Wednesday is cancelled due to illness. Jackie and Vic are spouting from both ends, apparently, and aren't expected in until next week, so you've got some breathing space."
"Thanks." I try not to groan. I'll try not to obsess about Peter Fred fucking up the wiring loom too much.
"Don't worry," she waves a hand vaguely. "The cabling's all going to be outsourced from next year anyhow."
That gets my attention.
"Outsourced?"
I realize that shouting might deliver entirely the wrong message about my suitability for return to work, and moderate my voice. "There are several very good reasons why we do our own cabling, starting with security and ending with security. I really don't think outsourcing it is a very good idea at all, unless it's the kind of outsourcing which is actually insourcing to F Division via a subcontractor arrangement to satisfy our PPP quota requirements." And that's another 10 minutes wasted, bringing Iris up to speed on one of the minutiae of my job. It's not her fault she doesn't know where the dividing line between IT support scut work and OPSEC protocol lies, although she catches on fast when I explain the predilection of Class G3 abominations for travelling down Cat 5E cables and eating clerical staff. Not to say anything about the ease with which a bad guy could stick a network sniffer on our backbone and do a man-in-the-middle attack on our authentication server if we let random cable installers loose under the floor tiles in the new building. Finally, she leaves me alone, and I open the cover on Bloody Baron and start reading. An hour and a half later, I'm thoroughly spooked by my reading, so much so that I've had to put the file down a couple of times when I caught myself scanning the same sentence over and over again with increasing disbelief. It comes as something of a relief when Iris knocks on my door again.
"Showtime," she says. "You coming?"
I shake the folder at her.
"This is nuts. Welcome to the monkey house and have a banana."
She taps her wristwatch.
"Room 206 in 4 minutes.
I lock up carefully. The files I requisition from the stacks aren't secret or above, but it'd still be professionally embarrassing if anyone walked in on them, and sketch a brief ward over the door. It flickers violet, then fades, plugging into the departmental security parasphere. I hurry towards the stairs. Room 206 is upper level, with real windows and an actual view of the high street, if you open the dusty Venetian blinds. There's a conference table and a bunch of not-so-comfortable chairs, the better to keep people from falling asleep in meetings, and various extras, an ancient overhead slide projector, a lectern with a broken microphone boom, and a couple of tattered security awareness posters from the 1950s. "Is your co-worker a KGB mole, a nameless horror from beyond space-time, or a suspected homosexual? If so, dial 4-security. I suspect Pinky has been exercising his curious sense of humor again.
"Have a chair."
Iris winks at me. I take her up on the invitation as the door opens and 3 more attendees show up. Shona I recognize from previous encounters in ops working groups. She's in-your-face Scottish, on the plump side, and has a brusque way of dealing with bureaucratic obstacles that doesn't exactly encourage me to insert myself in her line of fire. I think she's something to do with the Eastern Europe desk.
"This is Shona MacDonald," says Iris, "and Vikram Chaudhry and Franz Gustafsson, our liaison from the AIVD, Unit G6.
Franz nods affably enough, but I try to conceal my surprise. It's an unusual name for the Netherlands, but I happen to know that his father was Danish. The last time I saw him, he was on what I was sure was a one-way trip to a padded cell for the rest of his life,
after sitting through one PowerPoint slide too many at a certain meeting in Darmstadt. The fine hair on the back of my neck stands on end. "We've met," I say, guardedly.
"Have we?"
Franz looks at me with interest. "That's interesting. You'll have to tell me all about it later."
Oh, so they only managed to save part of him.
"Allow me to introduce Bob Howard," Iris tells them, and I nod and force a bland smile to cover up the horror. "Mr. Howard is an SSO3 and double hats as our departmental IT security specialist, and also as personal assistant to Dr. Angleton. A decision was taken to add him to this working group." I notice the descent into passive voice. Also some disturbing double takes from around the table, from Schoner and Gustafsson. "He also, this is one of those coincidences I was talking about earlier, happens to be married to Agent Candid." At which name, Gustafsson drops all pretense at impassivity and stares at me as if I've just grown a second head. I nod at him. What the hell? Mo has a code word all of her own? Presumably for overseas assignments like the Amsterdam job, but still. "Bob, would you be so good as to summarize your understanding of the background to Bloody Baron for us?"
Oh, jeez. I clear my throat.
"I've only had an hour and a half with the case files, so I may be misreading this stuff," I admit. Shit, stop making excuses. It just makes you look lame. "Bloody Baron appears to be a monitoring committee tasked with... well, the Cold War never entirely ended, did it? There are too many vested interests on all sides who want to keep it simmering. And the upshot is that Russian espionage directed against the West has been rising since 2001. We kind of forgot that you don't need communism to set up an East-West squabble between the Russian Empire and Western Europe. In fact, communism was a distraction. Hence the current gas wars and economic blackmail." Iris winces. I'm wincing inside. If you had our heating bills last winter, you'd be wincing too. "Enough of the macro picture, if you don't mind. What's the micro?" "FSB activity in London has been rising steadily since 2001. I shrug. "The Litvinenko assassination, that embarrassing business with the Wi-Fi-enabled rock in Moscow in 05, diplomatic expulsions, the old confrontation is still bubbling under. But Bloody Baron is new to me, I will admit." I glance at the file on the table in front of me. "Anyway, there's an organization. We don't know their real designation because nobody who knows anything about them has ever defected, and they don't talk to strangers, but folks call them the 13th Directorate. Not to be confused with the original 13th Directorate, which was redesignated the 5th Directorate back in the 1960s. Nasty folks. They were the ones responsible for wet work. Mokria Djela. The current bearers of the name seem to have been forked off the KGB back in 1991, when the KGB was restructured as the FSB. They're an independent wing, much like us. The laundry was originally part of SOE, back during the Second World War. We're the part that kept on going when SOE was officially wound up at the end of hostilities. They're the Russian OCK Intel Agency, handling demonology and occult intelligence operations. Mostly they stay at home, and their activities are presumably focused on domestic security issues. But there's been a huge upsurge, unprecedented in overseas activity lately. 13th Directorate staff have been identified visiting public archives, combing libraries, attending auctions of historic memorabilia, and contacting individuals suspected of having contact with a former parent agency back before the end of the real Cold War. They've been focusing on London, but also visible in Tallinn, Amsterdam, Paris, Gdansk, Ulaanbaatar. The list doesn't make any obvious sense. I swallow. That's all I've got, but there's more, isn't there? Everyone's looking at me. Except for Gustafsson, who's watching Iris. She nods. That's the basic picture. Vikram? Chaudhry looks at me curiously.
Is Mr. Howard replacing Dr. Angleton on this committee?
I nearly swallow my tongue. Iris looks disconcerted.
Dr. Angleton isn't currently available, she tells him, sparing me a warning glance. There are human resources issues. Mr. Howard is deputizing for him.
Oh, Jesus. Wheels within wheels. Committee members who haven't been briefed. Russian secret demonologists. Cold War 2.0. What have I got myself into?
Oh, dear,
Chaudhry nods, mollified. Allow me to express my sympathies. He has a fat conference file in front of him. He taps the contents into line with tiny, fussy movements. His suit is black and shiny, like an EDS consultant's in the old days. Well then, we have been tracking a number of interesting financial aspects of the KGB activity. They appear to be spending money like water. We have requested information on IBAN transactions and credit card activity by the mobile agents we have identified, and while they're not throwing it away on silly luxury items, they have certainly been working on their frequent flyer miles. One of them, Agent Kurchatov, managed to fly 500,000 kilometers in the last 9 months alone. We believe he's a high-bandwidth courier, as an example, and they've been bidding in estate auctions. The overall pattern of their activity focuses on memorabilia from the Russian Civil War, specifically papers and personal effects from the heirs of white Russian leaders, but they've also been looking into documents and items relating to the Argentium Astrum, which is on our watch list, Bone Silver Star, along with documents relating to Western occultist groups of the pre-war period. Aleister Crowley crops up like a bad penny, naturally, but also Professor Mudd, who tripped an Amber Alert. Norman Mudd.
Civil War memorabilia? A nasty thought strikes me, but Vikram looks as if he's about to continue. What's special about Mudd? I ask. Chaudhry looks irritated.
He was a mathematics professor and an occultist, he says, and he knew F.
The legendary F. The laundry's first director of intelligence, reporting to Sir Charles Hambrough at 64 Baker Street, headquarters of the Special Operations Executive. Whoops. He cocks his head to one side.
If you don't mind.
I shake my head. Sorry, I'm new to this. Touchy, isn't he? Please continue.
Certainly. It looks as if the 13th Directorate are taking an unusual interest in the owners of memorabilia associated with the late Baron Roman von Ungern Sternberg, a conqueror of Mongolia, Buddhist mystic and white Russian leader. In particular, they seem to be trying to trace an item or items that Agent S-76 retrieved from Reval in Estonia on behalf of our old friend F.
Chaudhry looks smugly self-satisfied, as if this diversion into what is effectively arcane gibberish to me is supposed to be enlightening.
Any questions? He asks.
For once, I keep my gob shut, waiting to see if anyone else is feeling as out of the loop as I am. I don't have to wait long. Shona bulls ahead, bless her.
Yeah, you bet I've got questions. Who is this Baron Roman von Stauffenberg or whoever? When was he... Did he die recently?
Ungern Sternberg died in September 1921, executed by a Bolshevik firing squad after Trotsky's soldiers captured him.
Chaudhry taps his folio again, looking severe.
He was a very bad man, you know. He had a habit of burning paperwork, and he had a man nicknamed Teapot who followed him around and strangled people the Baron was displeased with. I suppose we could all do with that, ha ha.
He doesn't notice, or doesn't care about, Iris's fish-eyed glare.
But, yes, he was one of those Russian occultists. He converted to Buddhism, Mongolian Buddhism of a rather bloody sect, but stayed in touch with members of a certain theosophical splinter group he had fallen in with when he was posted to St. Petersburg. Obviously, they didn't stay there after the revolution, but Ungern Sternberg would have known of his fellows in General Denikin's staff, and possibly known of F, due to his occult connections, and the anti-Semitism.
He looks pained. All intelligence agencies have skeletons in their closets. Ours is our first director of intelligence, whose fascist sympathies were famous and only barely outweighed by his patriotism.
What can that possibly have to do with current affairs?
Shona's evident bafflement mirrors my own.
What are they looking for?
That's an interesting question, says Chaudhry, looking perturbed.
He glances at me, his expression unreadable.
Mr. Howard might be able to tell us...
What? My confusion must be as obvious as Shona's, because Iris chips in.
Bob has only just come in on the case. Dr. Angleton didn't see fit to brief him earlier.
Oh my goodness.
Chaudhry looks as if he's swallowed a toad. Live.
But in that case, we really must talk to the doctor.
You can't.
Iris shakes her head, then looks at me again.
Bob, we, the committee,
asked Angleton to investigate the link between Ungern Sternberg, F, and the current spike in KGB activity. She looks back at Chaudhry. Unfortunately, he was last seen on Wednesday evening. He's now officially AWOL, and a search is underway. This happened the same night as Agent Candid closed out Club Zero. The next morning, Candid and Mr. Howard were assaulted by a Class 3 manifestation, and I don't believe it's any kind of coincidence that Agent Kurchatov was seen visiting the Russian embassy in Kensington Palace Gardens that morning, and left on an early evening flight back to Moscow. Let me be straightforward. All the signs suggest that the 13th Directorate are suddenly playing very dangerous games on our turf. If the cultists who Club Zero shut down turn out to be a front for the 13th Directorate, then we have to assume that Club Zero is connected with Bloody Baron, and that turns it from a low-key adversarial tactical analysis into a much higher priority for us. They're not usually reckless, and they're not pushing the old ideological agenda anymore. They wouldn't be acting this openly for short-term advantage, so we need to find out what they're doing and put a stop to it before anyone else gets hurt. Yes, Bob. What is it? I put my hand down. This might sound stupid, I hear myself saying, but has anyone thought about, you know, asking them? I'm not big on history. When I was at school, I dropped the topic as soon as I could, right after I took my GCSEs. It seemed like it was all about one damn king after another, or one war after another, or a bunch of social history stuff about what it was like to live as an 18th century weaver whose son had run off with a spinster called Jenny, or a 16th century religious bigot with a weird name and a witch-burning fetish. Tedious shite, in other words, of zero relevance to modern life, especially if you were planning on studying and working in a field that was more or less invented out of whole cloth in 1933. The trouble is, you can ignore history, but history won't necessarily ignore you. History, as it turns out, is all around us. Service House, where I used to have my cubicle, is where the laundry moved in 1953. Before that, it used to belong to the Foreign Office. Before that, we worked out of an attic above a Chinese laundry in Soho, hence the name. Before that, there was no laundry, officially. The laundry was a wartime work of expedience, magicked into existence by a 5-line memo headlined, "Action This Day," and signed Winston Churchill. It was directed at a variety of people, including a retired Major General and sometime MI6 informer, whose dubious status was probably the deciding factor in keeping his ass out of an internment camp, along with the rest of the Nazi-sympathizing Directorate of the British Union of Fascists. That, and his shadowy connections to occultists and mathematicians, his undoubted genius as a tactician and theorist of the arts of war, and the nuanced reports of his political officer, who figured his patriotism had a higher operator precedence than his politics. That man was F. Major General J.F.C. Boney Fuller. He's been in his grave for nearly half a century, and would doubtless be spinning in it fast enough to qualify for carbon credits as an environmentally friendly power source if he could see us today in all our multi-ethnic, anti-discriminatory splendour. But who cares? That is, indeed, the big-ticket question. Before the laundry, things were a bit confused. You can do magic by hand, without computers, but magic performed by ritual, without finite state automata in the loop, calculating machines in other words, tends to be haphazard, unreliable, uncontrollable, prone to undesirable side effects, and difficult to repeat. It also tends to fuck with causality, the logical sequence of events, in a most alarming way. We've unintentionally rewritten our history over the centuries, would-be sorcerers unwinding chaos and pinning down events with a dead hand of consistency, always tending towards a more stable ground state because chaos is unstable. Entropy is magic's great enemy. When the ancients wrote of gods and demons, they might well have been recording their real-life experiences, or they may have drunk too much mushroom tea. We have no way of knowing. Let's just say that you can't always trust the historical record and move swiftly on. On the other hand, unreliability never stopped anyone from using a given technology. Just look at Microsoft if you don't believe me. During the 19th and early 20th centuries, the scholars of Knight systematized and studied the occult with all the zeal Victorian taxonomists could bring to bear. There was a lot of rubbish written, Helena Blavatsky, bless her little cotton socks, muddied the waters in an immensely useful way, as did Annie Besant and Krishnamurti and a host of others. And then there were those who came too damned close to the truth. If H.P. Lovecraft hadn't died of intestinal cancer in 1937, something would have had to have been done about him, if you'll pardon my subjunctive. And it would have been messy, very messy. If old H.P.L. was around today, he'd be the kind of blogging and email junkie who's in everybody's RSS feed, like some kind of giant mutant gossip squid. Then there were those who were sitting on top of the truth, if they'd had but the wits to see it. Dennis Wheatley, for example, worked down the hall in deception planning at SOE, and regularly did lunch with a couple of staff officers who worked with Alan Turing. The man himself, not the anonymous codenamed genius currently doing whatever it is they do in the secure wing at the Funny Farm. Luckily, Wheatley wouldn't have known a real paranormal excursion if it bit him on the arse. In fact, looking back to the dusty Manila files, I'm not entirely sure that Dennis Wheatley's publisher wasn't on the deception planning payroll after the war, if you follow my drift. But I digress. It was to our great advantage during the Cold War that the commies were always terrible at dealing with the supernatural. For starters, having an ideology that explicitly denies the existence of an invisible sky daddy is a bit of a handicap when it comes to assimilating the idea of nightmarish immortal aliens from elsewhere in the multiverse, given that the NIAs in question have historically been identified as gods, subtype Elder. For seconds, blame Trofim Lysenko for corrupting their science faculty's ability to cope with new findings that contradicted received political doctrine. For thirds, blame the Politburo, which in the 1950s looked at the embryonic IT industry, thought tools of capitalist profitmongers, and denounced computer science as uncommunist. Proximate results? They got into orbit using hand calculators, but completely dropped the ball on anything that required complexity theory, automated theorem proving, or sacrificial goats. But that was then, and this is now, and we're not dealing with the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. We're dickering with the Russian Federation, when we're not trying to save ourselves from the end of the world, that is. The Russians are no longer dragged backwards by the invisible hand of Lenin. Their populace have taken with gusto to god-bothering and hacking. Their official government ideology is hail to the chief, and Moscow is the number one place on the planet to go if you want to rent a botnet. There's a pragmatic and pugnacious attitude to their overseas operations these days. Their ruling network, the Siloviki, aren't playing the great game for ideological reasons anymore. Even though they came out through the KGB prior to the years of chaos, they're out to make Russia great again and grab a tidy bank balance in the process. And they're playing hardball because they're pissed off at the way they were shoved off the board during the 1990s, consigned to the dustbin of history, asset stripped by oligarchs and bamboozled by foreign bankers. And so, to the present. The whole of Western Europe, and a bunch of far-flung outposts beyond, are currently crawling with KGB foot soldiers. No longer the stolid, grey-suited trustees of Soviet-era spy mythology, they come in a variety of shapes and sizes. But they have two things in common: snow on their boots and blood in their eyes. And if they're looking for something connected with our founder and deploying supernatural weapons on our territory, we need to know why. Chapter 6. Red Orchestra. Let us temporarily look aside from your humble correspondent's work diary to contemplate a very different matter. A vignette of street life in central London. I am not myself a witness, so this is, to some extent, a work of imaginative reconstruction. Visualize the scene. A side street not far from Piccadilly Circus in London. An outrageously busy shopping district crammed on both sides with fashion chains and department stores. Even the alleys are lined with bistros and boutiques, tidied up to appeal to the passing trade. Pedestrians throng the pavements and overflow into the street, but vehicle traffic is light, thanks to the congestion charge, and slow, thanks to the speed bumps. Here comes a red-haired woman, smartly dressed in a black skirt, houndstooth check jacket, medium heels. She's holding a violin case in one hand, her face set in an expression of patient irritation beneath her makeup. A musician heading to a recital, perhaps. She looks slightly uncomfortable, out of sorts, as she weaves between a pair of braying office workers, yummy mummies pushing baby buggies the size of lunar rovers, a skate punk in dreads, and a beggar woman in hijab. She cuts across the pavement on Glasshouse Street, crosses the road between an overheating BMW X5 and a black cab, and turns into Shaftesbury. Somewhere in the teeming alleys behind Charing Cross Road, there is a narrow-fronted music shop, its window display empty but for a rack of yellowing scores and a collection of lightly tarnished brass instruments. The woman pauses in front of the glass, apparently examining the sheet music. In fact, she's using the window as a mirror, checking the street behind her before she places one hand on the doorknob and pushes. Her close-trimmed nails are smoothly sheathed in enamel, the colour of overripe grapes. There are calluses on the tips of her fingers. A bell jingles somewhere out of sight as she enters the shop.
Good afternoon.
One side of the shop is occupied by a counter, glass-bound in old oak, running back towards a bead-curtained alcove at the rear of the premises. A cadaverous and prematurely aged fellow with watery eyes, dressed as conservatively as an undertaker, shuffles between the hanging strings of beads and blinks at her disapprovingly.
Mr. Dower? George Dower?
The woman smiles at him tightly, her lips pursed to conceal her teeth.
I have that honour, yes.
He looks at her as if he wishes she'd go away.
Do you have an appointment?
As a matter of fact, the woman slides a hand into her black leather handbag and produces a wallet, which falls open to display a card.
I do. Cassie May from Sotheby's. I called yesterday.
The card glistens with a strange iridescent sheen in the dim artificial light.
Oh, yes.
His expression brightens considerably.
Yes, indeed. A restoration project, I am to understand.
Possibly.
The woman swings her violin case up above the glass counter, then gently lowers it.
Our client has asked us to obtain a preliminary valuation, and also to inquire about the cost of certain necessary restoration work for an instrument of similar manufacture that is currently in storage in a degraded condition. It's too fragile to move.
She reaches into her handbag again, and when she takes her hand out, she's holding an envelope.
Before examining the instrument, I would like you to sign this non-disclosure agreement.
She removes a thin document from the envelope. Mr. Dower is surprised.
But it's just a violin. Even if it's a rarity...
He does a double take.
Isn't it?
The woman shakes her head silently, then hands him the papers. Mr. Dower scans the first page briefly, then glances up at her.
This isn't from Sotheby's.
If anybody asks you who I am and why I'm here, you will tell them I'm Cassie May from Sotheby's Auction House, inquiring about a valuation.
She doesn't smile.
You will now read the document and sign it.
Almost as if he can't help himself, Mr. Dower's eyes return to the document. He scans it rapidly, mumbling under his breath as he turns the three pages. Wordlessly, he produces a pen from his inside jacket pocket.
Not like that.
The woman offers him a disposable sterile needle.
First, you must draw blood, then sign using this pen.
She waits patiently while he presses a digit against the needle, winces, and rubs the nib of the pen across the ball of his thumb. He makes no complaint about the unusual request, and doesn't seem to notice the way she produces a small sharps container for the office supplies, and carefully folds the document back into its envelope.
Good. By the authority vested in me, I bind you to silence, under pain of the penalties specified in this document. Do you understand?
Mr. Dower stares at the violin case as if stunned.
Yes,
he mutters. The woman, who calls herself Cassie May, unclips the lid of the violin case and lays it open before him. Mr. Dower stares into the case for 10 long seconds, barely breathing. Then he shudders.
Excuse me,
he says, hastily covering his mouth. He turns and stumbles through the bead curtain. A few seconds later, she hears the sound of retching. The woman waits patiently until Mr. Dower reappears, looking pale.
You can shut that,
he tells her.
If you want, she shrugs. I take it you've seen one before.
Yes.
He shudders again, his gaze unfocused. He seems to be staring down inner demons.
What do I have to do to get you to take it away?
You give me a written evaluation.
She has another piece of paper, this one containing a short list of bullet points.
As I said,
A preliminary estimate of the cost of repairing such a relic, a half-gram sample excised from the corpse of another identical instrument. All necessary materials to be provided by the customer. If you can assess the nature of the bindings that hold it together, my employers would like to be able to replicate them. He stares at her.
Who are you from? Who sent you here?
I'm from the government department responsible for keeping instruments like this out of your shop. Unfortunately, there is a time for business as usual, and then... Well, can you do it?
Mr. Dower stares at the wall behind her.
If I must.
Good. If you attach your invoice to the report, I will see that it is processed promptly.
When do you need the report?
He asks, shaking himself as if awakening from a dream.
Right now.
She walks over to the door and flips the sign to closed.
But I...
He swallows.
I'm required to stay within arm's reach of the instrument at all times, and to remove it from your premises when you're not working on it.
The woman doesn't smile. In fact, her expression is faintly nauseated.
Why? To prevent me stealing it?
No, Mr. Dower. To prevent it from killing you.
I'm back in my office after the Bloody Baron meeting. The committee have minuted that I am to try and think myself into Angleton's shoes. Ha, bloody ha. The coffee mug is cooling on the mouse mat beside my cranky old HP desktop as I sit here, head in hands, groaning silently, and wishing I'd paid more attention in history classes rather than staring at the back of Zoe McCutcheon's head and thinking about, let's not go there. 16-year-old male, fill in the blanks. All this Russian stuff is confusing the hell out of me. Why can't we go back to worrying about Al-Qaeda or paedophiles on the internet or whatever it is that intelligence services traditionally obsess about? There's a pile of dusty manila folders sitting on my desk. Angleton said they were interesting right before he went missing, and if that wasn't a deliberate clue, I'll eat my pants. He's a slithy old tove, and I wouldn't put it past him to have meant something significant. Damn him. But all I've got is a list of hastily scrawled file reference numbers, pointers into the shelf positions documents are stored at in the stacks. Nothing as simple as file names, of course. That would be giving valuable information to the enemy. How like Angleton. I pick up the first folder and open it. It contains a creased, dog-eared, and much-folded letter, handwritten on paper that's a weird size. I peer at the faded scrawl, trying to make head or tail of it. Jesus, boss, what the hell? Luckily, I have a scanner with an automatic document feeder. I carefully feed the brittle pages to the computer, one at a time, twitching the software to maximum resolution. On the first page, I pick up a reasonable high-contrast scan. There's some ghosting, what looks like pale scribble showing through, as if the author tried to scrub something out, and zoom in. I puzzle out the date first, October 11th, 1921. Then I turn the handwriting recognition software loose and sit back. After a while, it's cooked and ready to read. Classified, S7645. Dear John, first of all, greetings from Ravel. I sincerely hope this letter finds you experiencing a more clement climate than the Estonian autumn, which has clamped down in earnest this past week. Please give my best regards to Sonia. I assume you have already received word through the wires about the execution of the Beast of Dauria last month. By all accounts, he was given as fair a trial as the Reds could manage, and if even a tenth of the allegations levelled against him are true, then I can't see that they had any alternative but to shoot him. I have been paying special attention to the reports filtering out of Siberia about Semenov's bandits, and Ungern Sternberg was by far the worst of a bad bunch. It was a beastly affair, and a bad end to a thoroughly bad fellow, and perhaps we should thank the Reds for ridding us of this monster. However, his death leaves certain questions unanswered. I decided to visit his parents, not his father, but his mother and her husband, Sophie Charlotte and Baron Oscar von Heuningen-Höhner. They live in Yerverkant, and although the weather is dismal, the snow is already lying 4 feet thick on the ground, I was able to arrange a weekend visit. As you probably know, madness stalks the Ungern Sternberg line. The Baron's father, Theodore, once a keen amateur geologist noted for his interest in unusual fossils, is in a sanatorium to this day. In my estimate, Sophie Charlotte suffered considerably by proximity,
for he deteriorated while they were still married. It is a difficult topic to raise in conversation, especially in light of the unfortunate fate of her son, and so I did not seek to disturb her, but made my observations indirectly. The Heuningen-Herner estate is a stately home that would grace any family of means in any country. By winter, it presents a fairy tale face to the world, its steeply pitched roofs and turrets peaceful beneath a blanket of snow, an island of tranquility in the middle of the gloomy pine forest. But it is a fairy tale out of the Brothers Grimm, rather than the bloodless and bowdlerized fare that our parents' generation sought to raise us on. This is a castle of the German aristocracy, descendants of the Teutonic Knights and servants of the Russian Empire until the late upheaval deprived them of the object of their loyalty. And it is an estate that has been cut down to size, thanks to the decrees of the Rigi Kogu, relating to land reform and the rights of the peasants to the fruits of their labor. Yevgenia and I visited with the Heuningen-Herners last weekend, ostensibly to write a tub-thumper for The Guardian about the equitable settlement in Rappler County, which has not seen so much turbulence and persecution of the former rulers as other areas. I put it about that we would also like to see the countryside thereabouts, and talk to some of the local landlords about the recent changes. The Guardian's status as an English newspaper outweighs its political reputation in the backwoods. I had no shortage of correspondence, mostly of the indignant of Colchester variety so familiar to us from the letter columns. On Sunday afternoon, after the obligatory morning visit to the chapel, which was very Lutheran in that manner that is peculiar to the Baltic territories, with gloomy dance macabre and carved skull heraldry above the bare wood pews, and do I need to add, unheated even in winter, I had a chance to chat with the Baron, and by way of two or three glasses of schnapps, the subject of the prodigal rose to the surface. "He has always been a disappointment to me, and a tribulation to his mother," quoth Oscar Heuningen-Herner. "This latest shame is but the final straw, luckily the final one, on the pyre of his depravity." He sighed deeply at this point. "I tried to beat sense into him when he was young, you know, but he was always a wild one. Took after his father, and then there was the obsession with shamanism, like the nonsensical garbage Theodore plagued my wife with before she divorced him." "Garbage?" I asked, digging. I intimated, indirectly, that I had been asked to prepare a column about his adoptive son, but had declined to do so out of respect for the recently bereaved. Oscar snorted. "No son of mine," he said with cold deliberation, "would have done what that beast did. He wrote us letters, you know, boasting of it. Executing prisoners by quartering, tying their limbs to springy saplings. Mass hangings, stabbings, shootings. Said he was going to line the road to Moscow with commissars and Jews, impaled every couple of yards. Heaven knows I've got no time for Yids myself, but he pledged to kill them all, to purify Russia and reinstate serfdom. Can you believe it? And there was other stuff, dark stuff, absolutely disgusting." I asked what he did with the letters. "I burned them," he said indignantly, "all but a couple that Sophie refused to let me have. I hadn't the heart to deprive her of, well, memories." He subsided into a sulky silence for a few minutes, but bestirred himself with the assistance of a fresh glass. "There were his father's fossils, you know. I think that's where the rot set in." "Fossils?" I asked. "Rum things, never seen anything like them. I think Sophie left them in the boys' room. He used to play with them when he was a tot, you know. I'd find him staring at the things, thought he was going to grow up to be a geologist like his pa, which would have been no bad thing compared to how he turned out." "Knowing of your interests and learning that his mother had actually preserved the prodigal's bedroom untouched, as if she expected her son to return, I availed myself of an opportunity to look inside, in hope of getting some insight into his character. Enclosed, 8 faded black-and-white photographs of irregular pieces of rock cleaved along fracture planes. Most of the pieces appear to be slate, although it is hard to be certain. The fossils resemble certain other samples referenced by code word Anning Blue Skull. I think we've seen the like of these pieces before, haven't we? In those days, giants walked the earth. I shall make indirect inquiries to see if it is possible to acquire Roman von Ungern Sternberg's boyhood fossil collection for the nation, and, if possible, his mother's collection of letters. I shall also attempt to arrange a follow-up visit, although it is now unlikely to be practical until the spring thaw.
Chateau Heuningen-Höhner is somewhat isolated, and polite society does not travel much in winter. A premature visit would invite unwelcome scrutiny. Meanwhile, I shall be wintering in Ravel, and will make use of my free time to investigate further the matter of the bloody White Baron and the mystery he discovered in the Bogd Khan's palace. Your obedient friend, Arthur Ransom.
The woman who calls herself Cassie May waits patiently, sitting on a backless stool behind the antique cash register in George Dower's shop, while keeping an eye on the proprietor, who is busy in the workshop behind the bead curtain, which she has tied back to afford her a clear view. The back of the shop is not what she had expected. She's been in instrument makers' workshops before, smelled the glue and fresh planed wood, the wax and varnish. She's familiar with other musical specialties as well, with signal generators and plug boards, amps and filters, the hum and hot metallic smell of overdriven amplifiers. Dower's shop is not like any of these. It has some of the characteristics of a jeweler's workshop, or a watch repairer's, but it is not entirely like either of those. It's summer, but the air is uncharacteristically chill, and not from the air conditioning. It's stuffy, and there's a faint charnel house scent, as if something has died under the floorboards. Dower has donned a pair of white cotton conservator's gloves and hung a dictaphone around his neck. He keeps the bone-white violin at arm's length, as if he doesn't want to hold it too close, muttering into his microphone.
C-rib thickness varies between 3.2 and 5.5 millimeters. As with the right lower curve, this material appears to be ductile and rigid, although examination at 6x magnification reveals the characteristic spongiform structure of an endochondral ossification.
He swallows, as if nauseous, as well he might be. The instrument is indeed made of bone, preserved and treated to give it a rigidity and resonance similar to mountain maple. The treatments that modify the material in this way are applied while its donor is still alive and in excruciating pain. Peering into a fiber-optic probe, the end of which is inserted through one of the violin's F-holes.
The upper block appears to be carved from the body and the lesser cornu of os hyoideum. The greater cornu is avulsed in a manner usually indicative of death by strangulation.
Dower may suspect, but the woman knows that the materials used to construct this instrument were harvested from the bodies of no less than 12 innocents, whose premature deaths were believed to be an essential part of the process. Before he became a highly specialized instrument maker, Dower trained as a surgeon. He's a sensitive, trained to see what lies before his eyes. Most people wouldn't recognize the true horror of the instrument, seeing merely a white violin, which is why the woman came here, after checking the files for a list of suitable examiners. After almost 3 hours, Dower is flagging, but his work is nearly done. The woman is checking her watch now, with increasing concern. Eventually, finally, he replaces the bow in its recess and folds the lid of the case shut, snapping the latches closed. He steps back and fastidiously peels off his gloves, then drops them in a rubbish bin, being careful not to touch their contaminated outer surface with his bare skin. Finally, he clicks off the dictaphone.
"I'm done," he says flatly.
The woman stands, smooths the wrinkles out of her skirt, and nods.
"Your written report," she says.
"I'll write it up after I've had some lunch. You can collect it after 4 this afternoon."
She shakes her head. "It won't be back." Reaching into her bag, she pulls out another envelope. "Print out one copy of your report, and no more, and place it in this envelope. Then seal it and post it." There is no address on the envelope. "After you have done that, you should destroy your records. Erase your word processor files, burn the tapes, whatever it takes. You will be held responsible if your report leaks."
"But there's no..."
He takes the envelope.
"You're sure?"
"If you post that envelope, I will have the contents on my desk by morning," she tells him, staring at him with pale green eyes as unquiet as a storm surge.
"I don't want to see that thing ever again," he tells her.
"You won't."
"But you want to know how to make more?"
"No."
Her face is as smooth as plaster, as if any hint of human emotion might crack the surface of her glaze. "I want to prove to my superiors that the cost is too high."
"Isn't that obvious?"
Not given the magnitude of the threat we face. Desperate measures are called for.
I merely believe this one to be too desperate.
Goodbye, Mr. Dower. I trust we shall never meet again.
Back in the office. Photograph 1. A large slate resting on a table beside a wooden measuring rod. According to the rod, it is 20 inches high, and, inferred using a ruler, 18 inches wide. Cleaved along a plane, it reveals a well-preserved fossil of what appears to be a starfish of class Asteroidea. On closer inspection, there is something wrong with the fossil. Although it possesses the characteristic five-fold symmetry, each tentacle tip appears to be blunt, as if truncated. Moreover, the body doesn't show signs of radial segmentation. It's an integral whole, giving an effect more like a cross-section through an okra fruiting body, or perhaps an oversized echinoderm, a sea cucumber. Photograph 2 is another large slab of broken rock, this time revealing the partially dissected and fossilized arm of a juvenile blue Hades. Photograph 3 is in the pile Bob has just dumped on the floor. I rub my eyes and quietly snarl. Fuck this shit. The temptation to start jumping up and down and shouting is well nigh irresistible, but my office shares a plasterboard partition with that of an easily distracted computer-phobic project manager, and the last time I punched the wall, he made me come round and put all of his Gantt chart stickies back in the right order on pain of being forced to attend a training course on critical path analysis, which is deeply unfair in my book. If the lines on one of Roskill's charts don't join up, all that happens is a project goes over budget. Nobody gets eaten or goes insane, unless the auditors decide to get involved. But there's no arguing with him. Ex-RAF type, thinks he runs the country. It's almost too late for lunch, and all I've succeeded in figuring out so far is that F had a lot of interesting correspondence in the Baltic states, not to mention a huge and not entirely rational hard-on for the Bolsheviks. Mind you, he was a bit unhinged in more ways than that. On the other hand, this ransom chap seems to have had his head screwed on. A journalist, obviously, but corresponding with a colonel in the War Office? And his correspondence ended up filed in the laundry archives? That's pretty suggestive. And those photographs? Roman von Ungern Sternberg clearly had a disturbed childhood, if his idea of fossil collecting involved elder race relics. No wonder Daddy ended up in the loony bin, and Mummy shacked up with a boringly conventional country squire with no questionable hobbies. I look at the stack of files. 9 of the bloody things, brown manila envelopes with dates and security classifications scribbled on their front, beneath the familiar Donar geometry curve of the internal security sigil. Read this without authorization and your eyeballs will melt. Or words to that effect in one of the simpler Enochian meta-languages. They're identified by number, using a system we call the Codex Mathemagica. 4 3-digit quads, just like IP addresses. And isn't that a significant coincidence, given that the laundry archives predate the internet by 30 years? Although the laundry stacks use decimal as a native format, not 2 hex digits, now that I think about it. Does that mean their original numeric routines were written to manage BCD primitives? With no overall meaning except that they're unique in the index. 9 folders. I rummage around on my desk for the original paper Angleton gave me. Weren't there 10 files there? 10 sets of numbers? I can't find the note, damn it, but I know where I entered the document retrieval request. I wake my computer and call up the transaction log. Yep, 10 files requested. I look under my desk. Then I look behind my desk. Then I look in the circular filing cabinet just in case. I recount the folders, double-checking inside them just in case the missing file has been interleaved. 9 folders. Shit. Have you ever found yourself in a cold sweat, your palms clammy and your clothes sticking to the small of your back? Heart hammering, even though you're sitting down? Mouth dry as a mummy's tomb? I am a rough, tough, hardened field agent. Yeah, right. I have been in the laundry for nearly a decade. I've met gibbering horrors from other universes, been psychically entangled with a serial killer fish goddess, stalked by zombies, imprisoned by a megalomaniac billionaire, and I've even survived the attention of the auditors, when I was young, foolish, and didn't know any better. But I've never lost a classified file before,
and I don't ever want there to be a first time. I force myself to sit down and close my eyes for what feels like an hour, but is actually just under 2 minutes according to the clock on my computer's screen. When I open my eyes, the problem is still there, but the sweat is beginning to dry and the panicked feeling has receded. For now. So I get down on my knees and start picking up the photographs, working through them until I am certain I've got them all in sequence, and then I put them in the correct envelope and very carefully stack it on my chair. I pick up a post-it pad and copy the number of the front of the envelope. Then I repeat 8 times for the remaining envelopes. Then I hunt across my desk until, aha, I find Angleton's original spidery scrawl, numbers swimming before my eyes like exotic fish. 10 numbers. I go through them, checking off the files I've got, until I identify the number that's missing. 10.0.792.560. Right. I call up the requisition and look for 10.0.792.560. Sure enough, it's there. So I ordered it, but it isn't in my office. Double shit. I dumpster dive the transaction file, looking for my request. Did they fill it? Oh. Oh my. Document not found on designated shelf. I just about faint with relief, but manage to force myself to pick up the phone and dial the front desk number.
Hello? Archives?
The voice at the far end is female, distracted, a little squawky, and all human, for which I am grateful. Not all the archive staff are warm-blooded. Hi, this is Bob Howard in Ops. Back on Thursday, I requested an archival document retrieval, 10 dead files. I'm going through them now, and one of them is missing. I've got a file number and an annotation saying document not found on designated shelf. Can you tell me what that means?
It means,
she sounds irritated,
the librarian couldn't find your file. They looked where it was supposed to be and it wasn't there.
Oh, is there a direct mapping between the document reference number and a given shelf?
Yes, there is. You should really use code names and the index in case the file's been assigned a new number, you know. It happens sometimes. Do you have a code word for me? I could look it up for you.
I'm sorry, my colleague just gave me a list of document reference numbers, I explain. And he's, off sick, so I'm trying to figure out what's missing. I was worried that the file had been sent over and got misplaced, but if it's missing in the stacks, I suppose that just means it's been renumbered. Or he wrote down the wrong reference, or something. I don't believe the last one for a split second. No way would Angleton get a file number wrong. But I don't want some nosy librarian poking her nose into my investigation. Bye. I put the phone down and lean back, thinking. Let's see. Angleton was working on Bloody Baron. When I came back to the office, he gave me a list of 10 files to read, then he went missing. This coincides with an upswing in Russian activity, including a marked willingness to use extreme measures. 9 files came from the stacks, and they turn out to be tedious backgrounders relating indirectly to the historical investigation side of Bloody Baron. The 10th file isn't on its shelf. All I've got is a number, not a name. I think it's time to do some unofficial digging. Meanwhile, back to the historical reconstruction. It is nearly 6 o'clock when Mr. Dower finishes typing his report. He's lost track of the time, his head locked inside the scope of his post-mortem on the instrument. He's read about it like before. Their design is attributed to a deaf-mute German violinist in Paris in the early 1920s, but nobody actually built one until the ghastly Dr. Mabuse commissioned an entire string section from a certain Berlin instrument maker in 1931. It should be no surprise that the instrument maker prospered under the subsequent regime, but was executed after a summary trial by Smirsch investigators in 1946. This particular instrument made its way to the West in the luggage of a returning GI, was retrofitted with electric pickups during the 1950s, and after a spectacular run of accidents, was acquired by a reclusive collector in 1962, believed by some to be a front for a British government department, who, as a matter of state policy, did not like to see such instruments in the wrong hands. He dreads to think what its reappearance portends. On the other hand, the young woman who brought it to him, Mr. Dower thinks of everyone aged under 50 as young, seemed to have a sober appreciation of its lethality. He shudders fastidiously as the last of 5 pages of single-space description hisses out of the inkjet printer. It joins the half-dozen contact pages of photographs, including his fibre-optic examination of the interior of the instrument and an invoice for just over £2,000. He shakes the bundle of pages together and binds them neatly with a paperclip from a desk drawer. Then they go inside the envelope the woman who called herself Cassie May gave him. He licks the flap and seals it. Then, in a moment of curiosity, he switches on the anti-counterfeit lamp he keeps by the cash register and examines it under ultraviolet light. Nothing shows up. It bears none of the UV fluorescent dots the post office prints on envelopes to control their routing. If Cassie May thinks she can retrieve an unmarked envelope from the postal system, she's welcome to it in Mr. Dower's books. He turns back to the computer and deletes his work, then sighs and glances at the clock. 5 minutes to closing time. No point keeping the shop open any longer. He stands and stretches, switches the computer off, and goes through an abbreviated version of his regular closing routine. No point banking the cash register contents. His takings before the woman's visit barely amounted to petty cash. He pulls on his coat, turns his coffee mug upside down on the draining board, switches off the lights, and opens the front door. The woman is waiting for him. She smiles. "Have you finished your report?" she asks. Mr. Dower nods, confused.
"I was going to post it, as you requested."
He pats his coat pocket.
"I'm in a hurry. There's a rush on. If you don't mind."
She looks at him impatiently.
"Of course."
He pulls out the envelope and hands it to her.
"My invoice is enclosed."
"You don't need to worry about that side of things."
She slides the envelope into her black patent leather handbag and smiles.
"I suppose not. You people always pay your debts eventually."
"Yes, you can be absolutely certain of that."
He turns back to the door and fumbles with his keyring, which is why he doesn't see her withdraw a silenced pistol from her bag, raise it to the back of his head, and discharge a single round into his cerebellum. The gun makes little sound, just the racking click of its action. But as she fires, the suppressor fitted to its muzzle frosts over with clear fluid, air in contact with its liquefying as it chills to just above absolute zero. Mr. Dower slumps forward against the door. The woman's arm follows him down with absolute precision and discharges a second round into the top of his skull, but it is unnecessary. He is already dead. She looks around with green eyes as deep as sacrificial cenotes, eyes in which a sensitive witness might see luminous worms writhing. But there are no sensitive witnesses to see through the glamour. Just the ordinary post-work crowd hurrying about their business on the London streets. For a moment, her face shimmers, the facade sliding. Her attention is strained, flying in too many directions to maintain the illusion effectively. But then she notices and pulls herself together. She returns the chilly pistol to her bag. Then, turning on one spiked heel, she strides away from the corpse. Just another professional woman on her way home from the office. Nobody has witnessed the killing, and it will be 20 minutes before a passing policeman realizes that the drunk sleeping in the doorway is never going to rise again.
This ends Disc 3.